Okay, I think we're going to start again. I see a whole lot of more people have arrived. I'd just like to introduce the next three speakers who are going to be talking about open education resources at UCT. Cheryl Hodgkinson-Williams is an associate professor at the Center for Educational Technology at UCT. And she's also the project director for open educational resources at UCT. She's involved in the Masters in ICT in the education program, and she coordinates the Mellon Scholarship of this program. She's also part of the Partnership for Higher Education project, which is supporting 7 universities in Ghana, Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, Nigeria, and Mozambique. It's helping them to develop educational technology strategies and implement educational technology projects over the next 4 years. And Cheryl was the project manager for the Opening Scholarship Research Project. And then Michelle Wilmers is also from UCT, and she has a background in academic publishing. She's been involved in the Shuttleworth-funded Opening Scholarship Project and is the project manager for the UCT OER project. And Michael Pascovicius is a postgraduate student, and he works part-time for the OER project. And he's a technical team member. So welcome and
thank you very much, Viv. I'm going to be presenting today on behalf of the team, but as you can see, Michelle and Michael are here to support me for any of the questions. In terms of who are we? We're part of a team at UCT when we're dealing with open education resources, and we're hosted by the Centre of Educational Technology. This project is funded by the Shuttleworth Foundation and builds on a previous research project called Opening Scholarship. In this project, we are busy undertaking an audit of potential open education resources at UCT. We plan to create a directory of open education resources at UCT by February 2010 and launch this directory, in order that we can showcase the kind of teaching materials that are available from UCT academics. But above all, we are committed to sharing the lessons that we have learnt through a documented case study that we will obviously make available to everybody. Now, if I had been a little more aware of what my colleagues who were talking before about clickers, I would have been able to use the clickers to ask you the question, who knows about open educational resources, that topic, OER. Who has had some exposure to OER? Now, unfortunately, the anonymity has gone. So now, and you can actually start seeing some of the value of, in fact, having the clickers, because now we're reverting back to who knows about this concept, in order that I may, what was the term used? Provide some contingent teaching that I know and what my audience know about open education resources. Hands up, anybody who's heard about the concept, just to give me an idea. Okay. All right. A couple of us, but for some of us, it's probably the first exploration of this. So let me start then with a definition. Open education resources are, in fact, materials usually digital, although they sometimes that they are paper-based, but usually they are digital, that are shared freely and openly for anyone to use, but under some kind of license. And in addition, you can repurpose it, improve it, and then redistribute that again. Now, the way this whole endeavor has come about has a rather interesting history. Way back in the late 1990s, when the internet was obviously becoming quite a feature internationally, a university, MIT, the Massachusetts Institute for Technology, started to think how they could perhaps use the internet to make money from the kinds of courses they ran already. And they undertook a fairly extensive research project, and it was a couple of years later, it was about a 12-inch document that they presented, and at the end they concluded there was absolutely no way in which they could create the experience where students worked alongside researchers at a campus-based university such as MIT. They couldn't recreate this online. So in other words, the internet might not be useful for trying to arrange ways in which they could make money. So after some time, and the then head of MIT, Charles Vest, is reported to have said, well, if we can't make money out of this, why don't we just give these materials away free? And in fact, that is what they landed up doing. And to date, they have over 1,900 of their courses, and they are complete courses, available online that you can go and check. Anybody can look at them. A student, another lecturer, a member of the public, anybody has an interest in what MIT are doing, those materials are made freely available. And in addition, and you'll see at the bottom of the screen here, they've got what they call highlights for high schools. And as we know, one of the difficulties in higher education is the link between school and education. So for example, a subject like philosophy, which in our South African schools, most students have not heard of, or anthropology, or psychology, or sociology. They have absolutely no idea what these things are, and they get to university, and now they need to choose their subjects, and quite frankly, they don't have a clue what they're actually choosing. So one of the things they've looked at is to try and make some of their materials, the introductory materials, available to schools, and they actually have got them on a separately indicated site, so that school children can go and have a look at these to get a flavour of what it's like, to try and understand what these subjects are. Of course, this does not mean that you can get a degree from MIT by using their educational resources. You still have to go to MIT to get the experience, to get the student-teacher interaction, and to get that whole experience at MIT. However, you can look at those materials. And in fact, it's not only for people outside the institution, but for people within the institution. And in fact, initially when MIT did an evaluation of how their materials were being used, it was very interesting to find that in fact their own lecturers were looking at each other's work. Their own students were going back and looking at the materials again and again, very similar to what Dick was talking about yesterday, is the podcasts. Podcasts would be one type of open educational resource that could be made available. And in fact, if in thinking about your institutions, you may find, if you think back, you don't necessarily know exactly what your colleagues, even in your same department, are actually teaching. There could be incredible overlap in what you're doing. Across the globe, in the UK, a very different and very interesting move took place, where MIT is a campus-based university, small, intensive campus-based university. The Open University in the UK is a distance education institution. They make money out of their teaching. And they took the extraordinary step of making some of their materials available as open education resources. Even more extraordinary was that, in fact, not only did they encourage people to use their materials, but they actually encouraged them to edit them, repurpose them, remake them, and then make them available to other people. So in other words, you might find a very useful resource that's available in the UK is in English, but in fact, you would like to have it in another language. And if you're able to translate that, you've got the same materials, but you want to make that translated material available, they are offering the ability to do that. Likewise, you might find a really useful resource, but the examples are not localized enough. So they're giving the opportunity to take the basic content and then localize those examples. And then you make your reworked material available to anybody else. This is what they call their lab space. And in fact, they currently have about 6,000 hours of their courses online, and this represents approximately only 3% of what they are what their whole curriculum offering is, whereas MIT are offering approximately 80% of what they actually have. So we've got two very different environments in which we're working here, one campus-based, one open education resources. Now, in terms of trying to make available all of these resources, how do you actually go and find them? So what we're starting to see is the emergence of what we've called portals that start to aggregate all these opening education resources into a single place. So, for example, if you're looking for a topic, you don't have to go to MIT and to Open University and to Rice and to Michigan and to Indiana or to one of the French universities that are doing quite a lot of work. You can actually come to a single portal, put in keywords, and start finding some of the resources that you need. OER Commons is one of the major portals. But in fact, these kind of portals are growing as we're talking. One of them is called Academic Earth, which is in fact aggregating academic video from various leading universities. And all of a sudden, we have the rise of the academic, the guru. Perhaps Socrates and Plato will rise again to become international stars. Not only are we looking at film and movie stars, we're starting to look at academic stars, people who can explain their subject matter really well. I mean, what opportunities we have here to actually hear the original author of a book, say, for example, or the original researcher of the research actually express their ideas face-to-face, as it were. We also have in Africa, the newly developed OER Africa, which is specifically geared toward providing open education resources for African academics. And in fact, the University of the Western Cape was the first out the starting blocks when it came to making materials openly available. And they have joined what is now called the Open Courseware Consortium, which was actually spawned by MIT. They realized very early on that, in fact, in order to share their resources, they had to make more than just the resources available. They actually had to make some of the infrastructure available. So, in fact, right now, there are huge developments of MIT's work translated into Chinese. There is a, in fact, it's even bigger than MIT in terms of the core. It's called Core, C-O-R-E. And in Japan, some of the very biggest universities in Japan have all localized some of the MIT materials and are now making them available. So what has enabled this new development of open education resources? In fact, there are about four particular features that we can isolate. Technically, obviously, the internet has afforded us opportunities to use and share materials in ways that is just not conceivable. That was conceivable in the print-based era. Secondly, we're looking at the legal issues. We have alternative copyright that is enabling us to look at how we copyright materials differently, and I'll go into these in a bit more detail. Also, we have a range of different ways of financially sustaining the sharing of teaching and learning materials. And finally, but most importantly, we have a different social perspective. We have a change in philosophy. And in fact, this is probably the biggest change. And really, this is a development of the open source software movement, which in fact led the way to changing the way in which people could be open, rather than keeping all their knowledge about developing computer code private, for example, the way Microsoft does. We had the alternative emergence of open source software, where people around the world were sharing code so that they could develop materials faster and that could be used in a variety of contexts, not just the one for which they were developed. And in fact, Tim O'Reilly, who comes from the open source movement, has explained, I think, really well the idea of what he calls the architecture of participation. He's actually showing how, instead of the usual way of relying on particular structures in society deciding on what is valuable and what is not valuable, who can program and who can't program. In the open source environment, people were able to contribute code, whether they were part of a university or they were a private programmer. If they had a useful solution that could be used, it could become part of the collective. And in the same way, the Open Education Resources Movement is building on this architecture of participation. You don't have to be a university lecturer. You could be a school teacher. You could be a person at home who's a housewife but has a particular interest in a field, but you can still contribute to that area. So in other words, what we find now is that the philosophical basis for OER is based on the idea that knowledge, in fact, is a collective social product. It's not something that is proprietary and should be kept in little silos at universities. But we, as a community, as a global community, is to try and make this knowledge more of a social property that is shareable. This, in fact, is the biggest move. Technically, although the internet has provided the opportunity to make this possible, the change in philosophy is the biggest single change that has made this whole movement possible. And in fact, even though we've got the affordances of the internet, the World Wide Web in particular, that gives us the opportunity to do it. It doesn't mean to say that just because we've got the opportunity, we don't have the right social infrastructure, we're not going to take up that opportunity. So while we need the internet, that in itself is not enough. It's a bit like with the clickers. You have the technology, but unless those clickers and the way you ask the questions are actually linked into the content of your lecture, the outcomes that you're wanting to achieve, the way you're using them for your contingent teaching, it's not in the technology per se, it's in the strategy that we use them. So what else has enabled? And in fact, this is probably, alongside the social change, the biggest enabler, which is alternative copyright. Previously, copyright was completely binary. You either had something that was fully copyrighted with all rights reserved, like a textbook, or you had something that was available in the public domain and everybody could share. There was a big divide between the two. Now what we're finding is that with the development of the general public license, which came out of the open source software environment, because in fact what they struggled with was they were sharing code quite happily, and then all of a sudden they realized, well, they can't just share the raw code. There's got to be some kind of documentation that goes with it. How do they share the documents? Is it a copyright? No, it's not. Is it public domain? No, it's not. There's something in between, because you do want to know who's the author of this, okay? So what has happened now is that people have stepped into that breach, and Professor Larry Lessig from Yale in particular, who conceived of the idea of Creative Commons licenses, which now provide a range where there are some rights reserved. Not all, and there's a range of them, and we're going to go through them. So not only do you have the copyright or the public domain, you now have a range of options in between. To give you a flavour, both of what it means in terms of the Creative Commons and some of the philosophy behind it, we're walking our talk, we're actually using an open education resource, which is a video that is available on YouTube about Creative Commons. And this, in fact, unfortunately, they haven't given all the names to the people who are interviewed, but these are some of the leading lights around the world who have put into place open education resources. For example, one of the people interviewed here is Jimmy Wales, the creator of Wikipedia, which is also a very, very different way of looking at encyclopedias that previously were these textbook-bound things. We've now got a very different look at what a public collaborative encyclopedia could look like. So let's just take a quick look at this video. It's about 3 minutes long. And if everything works.
What does it mean to be human if we don't have a shared culture? And what does a shared culture mean if you can't share it? It's only a...
Sorry, technically... We did check this before the time and it did work then.
It'll work. Thanks.
What does it mean we don't have a shared culture? And what does a shared culture mean if you can't share it?
So it's only in the last 100 or 150 years or so that we've started tightly restricting how that culture gets used.
The internet enabled an infrastructure where anybody can participate without asking permission.
We have all these new technologies that allow people to express themselves, take control of their own creative impulses, but the law is getting in the way.
Creative Commons is designed to save the world from failed sharing. People who actually want to share something, who put it up on the web because they want to share it on certain terms. So we wanted to create a simple way for creators to say to the world, here's the freedom that I want to run with my creative work. Here are the things you're allowed to do. Can I reproduce it? Can I copy it? Can I put it in my textbook? Can I use that photograph? Can I make a new version of it?
Creative Commons gives tools to creators to make a choice about copyright.
Creative Commons license can cover anything that copyright covers. Every license says, you need to give me attribution. I created this, give me credit for the work I did.
The basic choices are commercial use or not. Can you make derivative works, versions, adaptations, or not? And do you want me to have to share a life? So if I take your stuff, do I have to offer it to the next person under the same terms?
There's no requirement for you to do anything with your work other than what you want to do. You own the copyright, and what we've done is given you the right to exercise your copyright in more ways, more simply.
So the idea here is to enable the creative impulses that the technology turns loose and get the law out of the way.
The work of Creative Commons is really about laying the infrastructure groundwork for this new type of culture, a new kind of folk culture.
Somebody from Delhi, somebody from New York, somebody from Singapore
can feel comfortable using a photo that was created and given away by someone in the United States or in China or wherever that the licenses have been extended to.
With their identity being preserved.
Which means that people can actually create new kinds of things, come together and build things.
Mashups that people can do with people's photos.
And CC Mixer has allowed artists to make music together.
It's really about creativity and connection.
Access and control.
From amateurs who simply love what they're doing and they want to share it and want other people to be able to make use of it, to commercial organizations.
In the end, this will have a very successful place in the forefront kind of.
Creative Commons is the bridge to this future. Is you got to move away from thinking about content to thinking about communities. Communities that develop around content. And the sharing that the licenses allow enable these communities to come together.
A physical commons is like a park where anybody can enter equally. The commons with intellectual works is actually much freer.
It really is going to be the pillar for communication between people, cultural exchange.
A space for more speech, more free expression.
And that's the kind of commons we're trying to create.
Technically, what we've got here is a range we call degrees of openness. So in other words, rather than just having copyright to the public domain, we've now got a range that moved from the most restrictive to the most accommodating. So in other words, if you're wanting to share, what they mentioned was you always, and all of the licenses, you'll see there's a little icon of a little person, and with the little abbreviation by, you've always got to attribute the work to the original author. So it's nothing different from any of the research work that we're doing. You always, with any of the licenses, there is attribution. That's a given for everyone. Then after that, we start looking at that's attributed. Then we've got one that is attribution and share alike, which means you can attribute the work I'm doing, but you can also share it. Okay, you can use it, you can repurpose it, on condition that whatever you do, you share again. So in other words, you can't hold onto somebody else's work and just use it for yourself, because the condition of that license is that you are now obliged to reshare. And that, I think, is the essence of the Creative Commons. You can take, but you've got to share. And that little circle kind of indicates that. And then likewise, we go through various ones where you can share, but you're not allowed to make any derivatives. So for example, in some of the medical texts, it's really useful to be able to share them, but you don't really want anybody to be messing with that content. Okay, that's fine. You're making that quite clear. And then the last two we're looking at, you can still share, but you specifically can't make money out of it. So in other words, it's stopping people like big publishers going out there, taking your work and making a commercial venture out of what you're sharing. Okay. There are some debates around why that's a good or not a good thing, which we can perhaps pick up later. And then finally here we've got the non-commercial and no derivatives. In other words, this medical textbook cannot be taken by a publisher or anybody else and made available for profit, and you can't make any derivatives. So in other words, what we've got here is a range. Rather than not having any licenses, you can actually put in some licenses that are reserved. The most important thing is that as the developer of your own teaching materials, you retain the copyright. You may have found, some of those of you who've explored the venture into textbooks can sometimes be in that very awkward position where, as one of our UCT lecturers found herself, she and her colleagues wrote a very detailed book in a specific field, spent ages and ages developing it. By the time the publishers got hold of it and had produced this book, it was so expensive that the very students that they had prepared it for could not afford to buy it. And now they were in the sticky position because they had actually signed their copyright away to the publishers. So they couldn't take those materials now and photocopy them for the class because that was against the copyright. It was their own materials. So in this way, what we're saying to lecturers is there is another way in which you can actually hold on to copyright, particularly with teaching materials. In terms of the formats, the way in which you make things available also has quite a restrictive or a more accommodating possibility. So for example, if you're wanting to just make something available but you don't want anybody to mess with it, then putting it in a PDF form or in some kind of password protected document file, that's probably a good format. Okay. But if you're wanting people to change, then you need to make sure that you've made it available in a form that can actually be changed on a wiki, some kind of XML, some kind of open document format, some kind of HTML, something that will enable people to be able to repurpose it. Otherwise, you can't actually make that that change. Okay. Now, the other thing that's made OER possible is a different look at funding models. Previously, we've only thought about textbooks, materials being developed at universities, and somehow the materials are sometimes owned by the university or sometimes by the academic. Some of the regulations around that are very unclear at universities, and even the UK universities are having some trouble at the moment working out who actually owns the copyright of some materials developed at your university. The other is that you've actually created and put it into a textbook and you start earning revenue. Okay, but now we're looking at different ways. The Hewlett Foundation has invested large amounts of money in excess of $70 million over a period of time in the area of open education resources. As you can imagine, as funders, they're funding all these projects around the world and they are seeing, but this is the same as that, this could be copied from that. I mean, look at this crazy environment we're working in. So a lot of these big funders now are saying, if you take our funding, we want you to make the outcome of this particular project available for other people because we are very tired of paying for the same thing over and over and over again. Okay, the donors have a perspective that we have lost track of because we can't see it from their perspective. So they have provided a great deal of funding. Both MIT and Open University received quite a lot of funding, both from the Hewlett Foundation and Mellon. Then what the Open University has done instead, as an addition, to keep it sustainable, is that they have started looking at how they can use their Open Learn, which they, what the, their product is called, to attract new students. Because the students don't know what these things are. Remember, the Open University is about independent learners. So you can come from anywhere. You don't have to have any previous qualifications. You can take an Open University course. But people likewise don't necessarily know what all these courses are. So they're giving them tasters, as it were, for what these courses could be, and thereby increasing the number of people they're actually attracting to the Open University. And they have worked out that if 15% of the people who actually come to their open site actually become paying users, they've paid for their Open Learn initiative. So there's another one looking at marketing. MIT in this last year have come across a good product placement initiative, and that is that with every one of the MIT courses where there is some kind of link to a particular book that can be purchased from Amazon, every time there is a direct link, and obviously technically this is all working, from the MIT site to Amazon, Amazon automatically gives a 10% commission back to MIT. So MIT are earning revenue to keep this process going. We haven't thought about texts like this at all. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy is a very, very expensive resource that universities around the world have been paying for on a license basis every year. And they decided this is not actually going to be sustainable long term. So what they've done is they have asked the various universities for a lump sum. Okay? And this lump sum they have invested as an endowment, and they are running the development of this Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is a world-renowned resource, from that endowment fund. So that's another way of looking at it. The open source software environment Sakai, which is the one we use at UCT, it would be called Vula, runs on a membership or a subscription basis that every year you pay a license. But in a sense, the license is much cheaper than it would be if you'd actually have to do everything yourself. Likewise, at the moment, there is a new development in the UK. At the moment, it's only for the UK higher education institutions. It's called Joram. They are planning to make it open. But at the moment, you have to be part of a UK university to get access onto that site. But that also works in terms of the universities making are subscribing to this particular collective resource. And then just a few months ago, the UK government decided that, in fact, the universities were doing so many things and replicating in so many ways that they were actually not spending their higher education money very carefully. And they were saying, fine, what we'll do is we'll look at how we can give people money to actually start sharing resources, because we're developing teaching resources at such a pace in some of the disciplines that literally the lecturers aren't keeping up with the development before something has changed. And to produce really good lectures is a very time-consuming process, as you know. And if you've got a colleague at this university and that university who are redoing the same thing over again, okay, when you could actually be sharing some parts. So you do this part well and I do that part well, we share and everybody wins. The UK government is the first country that has actually looked at this from a national perspective and said, we have got to look at universities and the way we look at information differently. Well, why now? Why OER right now? Well, there are global and institutional and individual issues and benefits. And some of the benefits globally is that we really are advancing knowledge. Things are happening at such a pace that literally we're not keeping up. And the only way to keep up is to share more deliberately. So we're providing open access to high quality content to both educators and learners. So in other words, we're not just saying to students, you're only allowed to learn from materials from your university. You could actually learn from materials produced by other universities. That doesn't mean to say that you still have to put in, you still have to write your assignment for this lecturer at this university, and that university is still going to give you your qualification. But you can learn from a variety of places. It also globally provides a model of how we can put this new philosophy of sharing into practice. We have seen some of the limitations in this last economic crunch, and we realize that there may be other ways of doing things. We've become very used to a commercial way of looking at everything. And then obviously we provide, in this particular use in South Africa, an opportunity to display various perspectives. We often complain in South Africa that the textbooks we use are from Europe or the Americas or from Australia, and they're not used for our environments. The examples aren't right, the students don't find them relevant, etc., etc., but that it's too expensive for us to produce equivalent textbooks. Well, now we have the opportunity to provide some of our own, and more than that, we've got the opportunity to make our perspective available to the rest of the world. Because previously, we have kind of been users and consumers of intellectual capital from the West and from the northern countries, as it were. Now we can actually start providing a southern perspective. Institutionally, why are we doing it? Well, both MIT and the Open University have said it increases visibility. Despite the fact that MIT started this off very much as an altruistic initiative, they're very aware that their reputation has just gone sky high. A lot of people in the OER field, when you know about OER, you know about MIT. MIT has become a brand. People know about MIT. And in fact, now, to such an extent, people will look at a course and go, what does MIT do? MIT has created a brand for itself. It's becoming an intellectual brand. This is both a danger, if you can see that as well, because it's a particular perspective. Okay. Universities, it also, especially in South Africa, it provides opportunities for promoting social responsiveness and social engagement. Our government often asks us, how are higher education institutions actually responding to the local needs? And we're actually keeping a lot of our learning very much to ourselves, very elitist. We're not actually sharing what we're actually learning. Likewise, in terms of institutionally, what we're suggesting is this can improve the learning experience, that the learners can actually gain from looking at materials in other ways, because just because you are the lecturer at a particular university does not mean to say you have the last word on that subject. In fact, your colleague might have explained something better. And ultimately, if we're serious about our students' learning being our focus, then we ought to welcome those various opportunities. It also helps in recruitment, because students are allowed to see, I mentioned that earlier. But also, it has the opportunity for creating coherence across courses, where previously people were doing things, sometimes repeating things, sometimes in complete parallel, and we had no idea. I mean, even across disciplines, and particularly nowadays when we are looking at cross-disciplinary work, this is an essential thing, particularly at master's, you know, postgraduate level. Undergraduate level is one thing. And one thing that we do really well at universities, because we archive all our research work very well and we report on it to government, we do nothing formally with our teaching and learning materials. You leave a university, you leave with your files. Brand new lecturer comes in to a complete vacuum. How many of you have struggled with first year university lecturers with this kind of, what do I do? Frantic little deer in the headlights. Because what was there previously has gone. We know in South Africa we're dealing with a cohort of older lecturers who are now in their late 50s, early 60s, who are moving out. They're going to retire, and we know that we've got a problem in filling the places that's coming up. People are coming in and going out just as quickly. We are going to lose some of the intellectual capital because we've got no mechanism for curating it. No mechanism for preserving it. No mechanism for making it easily accessible to people who come after them. Individually, well, why do this? And this is going to take a lot of time, a bit of effort. Okay. Well, what we're saying is that you can actually profile your teaching as well as your research. A number of institutions actually have teaching portfolios that are now required. And people are frantically trying to find records of all the things they've got. If we start collecting them in ways like this, we can start having better records over time of what we've actually done. Likewise, we can foster connections between our other colleagues in our universities at our own universities and with others, and hopefully increase the impact of our teaching materials. In fact, the person lecturer from Oxford, in fact, who is the top star on iTunes for his podcasts, is a lecturer, believe it or not, who's lecturing on medieval English. And he has been top of the pops for 3 years. Now, who would have expected that somebody teaching medieval English, that was such an interesting thing for people to learn about? The consumers, as it were, the worldwide learners are deciding with their feet what they're actually finding interesting. And it's extending the use of materials beyond the university, both to high school learners and then this other untapped area, the lifelong learners. You are reading about some of the concerns we have about the limits of the currency of knowledge, that when first years are learning, by the time they get to fourth year, some of the stuff that they learned in first year is no longer the most up-to-date. We are going to have to develop a culture of lifelong learners. Where are these people going to learn? They want to come back to universities in some ways, not necessarily to register, maybe to learn, or maybe to take a short course. How are they going to know about what your short courses are? Okay? You've got to give them an idea. I mean, if you think about buying a car, you actually want to go and test it out before you drive it. Whereas, in fact, we give our customers very scant information before they spend quite a lot of money on fees about what they're going to get for that. All right, now in terms of some of the issues that still remain, we just have highlighted four areas, and if we've got some time, we could raise some discussion around them. But just as a few points, the key issues we're probably looking at is some of the incentives. Why would academics spend their time doing this? And perhaps reiterating some of the issues. Even at MIT and Open University, it's voluntary. Nobody is making this obligatory. So it is voluntary. But in a sense, it's actually linking into the kind of people we are as academics. We actually want to make a difference, not only to our students, but to other learners. MIT and Open University provide additional help in structuring your course, so you get some additional help, both in how you structure it and in the copyright. If you've got teaching grants, that would be ideal. We do have some at UCT. Does help demonstrate your teaching ability and your contribution to social responsiveness, and as I mentioned earlier, on keeping your own copyright and keeping your materials up to date. That's one of the challenges that we face, is that our materials are becoming obsolete so quickly. Yes, it does potentially undermine the profit, or the idea that it could undermine the publication for profit, but what MIT have found, that in fact it actually does the opposite. Actually promotes publications because it widens the market. Suddenly people realize who you are. Now, if you are the David Wiley, who was at Brigham Young University, and you now a household name, you want to buy the David Wiley book, okay? Because now you know it's out there. How will people know what you're doing unless you actually market yourself? So in fact, it actually has the opposite effect to what we anticipate. A tough one, quality assurance, but we have to look at the quality assurance thing perhaps in a slightly different light, and that is the individual academic is obviously going to be cautious about what they put up, because that's obviously going to be the public face you're presenting to the world. So there's your first level of quality. But most of the institutions have some kind of team that help the academic put those materials up, both in terms of the way in which they're taught and the copyright clearance. And in fact, there are other ways that are being used. Rice University, in their project Connections, is actually using a very interesting strategy, because they gather a whole lot of material, but like OER Commons, except they will actually host material for you, is that they have said to people, say, for example, from the Chartered Accountants, what's it called? A commission, whatever, you know, it's the association. The association. So professional associations can look at materials and go and give them their stamp of approval. So they can say, and that's across institutions. So the Chartered Accountants Association can say, right, this one from MIT, this one from there, that one from there, we think are excellent. So in other words, you're having a different way of looking at quality, relinking some of the professions back to the institutions. Likewise, with a lot of the things that we now become quite used to on the internet, with ratings, our little five stars, we're now placing the responsibility of giving people ideas of is this a useful resource or not to the actual users of the resource, right up front, and saying, how well do you think this is actually working? So these are some of the issues around quality assurance. Attendance at lectures. Will everybody disappear because everything's up on the internet now? Well, in fact, the manager of JISC, which is the Joint Information Steering Committee in the UK, has suggested, yes, it could. It could result in potential people not attending classes, but that's always been the case. If there's any way in which you can make a student's life easier, they won't. However, what we're looking at is a different idea, that instead of us thinking about higher education only being about lectures and attending lectures, with this massive information that we've got out there, these students are needing a path to help them through and somebody to respond to their questions. Help me understand. We have long moved on from the idea that there's the library. We don't say to the students, there's the library, go learn. We take that stuff, we mediate it, we select, we bring in different examples. It's no different in this field. The lecturers are still the mediators and helping people learn, not just read information. The process of gaining knowledge is not just sharing information. And I think we've got to be very aware that, in fact, this can actually increase the attendance at lectures. As people have this variety of information, what they're going to be looking at to the lecturer is to start weaving these together in ways that make sense for those students. So, finally, and this comes from a book from Iyoshi and Kumar, a confluence of events, the technical, the social, the legal, the financial, is creating what they call a perfect storm for significantly advancing education. And with a growing inventory of openly available educational tools and resources, and with an increasingly engaged and connected community, our students are expecting to be connected more than we were in our student days. Transformative opportunities for education abound. The good news is that the emerging open education movement in higher education and beyond is beginning to change the way educators use, share, and improve educational resources and knowledge by making them freely available and open for people to use. Thank you. You'll be happy to know that, apart from the references, these links are, we have got a number of links here, and that this in itself is an open educational resource, which you will be able to use. So in other words, as long as you attribute it to myself and Michelle and Michael, you will be able to take this material and reuse it again, as long as you share it in a similar way. Okay, the material actually is available on the site. Michelle's actually just handing out a paper-based version. The site actually will have this and other material, but this one in particular has got a little subdirectory that says Heltasa. And there are a number of other sort of little pointers we've given you in the little takeaway, as we've called it. So we hope we've walked our talk.
Yeah, I'm not sure you have. Thanks very much. Thanks for being absolutely on the dot on time. I think if anyone has questions, you can talk to Cheryl and us during tea time. I just wondered if the others could also make their PowerPoint presentations available so that we could perhaps send them to